we are happy to welcome back to the program a historian, a professor at Boston College, the author of a number of books, including How the South Won the Civil War. Her daily newsletter, Letters from an American, are a must-read for thousands, if not millions, of people in this country. She'll be appearing this Friday at the University of Maine's Collins Center, talking with Brian Naylor of NPR about the future of the humanities. It's a celebration of the McGillicuddy Humanities Center's first decade. Heather Cox Richardson joins us this afternoon. Thanks so much for squeezing us into your beyond busy schedule.
Oh, well, you know, today of all days, I can't boast that I've been busy because I'm actually, it's probably the first interview I've ever done with somebody who's wearing a wetsuit. I just came in off the water.
Fantastic. Well, that time we had Lloyd Bridges on. Well, thank you for being with us today. And by the way, happy belated birthday.
Thank you. It's been quite a 4 weeks between getting married, finishing a book, and turning 60, all in 4 weeks. I tell you, I need to stop and take a breath.
I would say so. Now, what was the most traumatic of all those events?
Honestly, the lack of time. Because it was one thing to write 1,200 words a night, every night on the letters. But when I added a book on top of that, that was really barely doable, if that. And then when you add on top of that, you know, family and friends and a wedding, and then a milestone birthday, it's been pretty busy.
I would say so. So I have to ask, I see the letters come in early in the morning sometimes. Usually if I have insomnia, I'm like, well, clearly Heather's still working. When in the world do you sleep?
Well, sadly, if it's a very late night like that, I have often fallen asleep head down on the table, which I think is so freaking grim. But, you know, otherwise, I sleep, you know, from whenever the letters are done, two or three, and before midnight the last two nights, which is what I'm always aiming for, until, you know, 7:30 or so. And then you know, I can't do it forever, but so far, so good. You know, when I set out to do them, I didn't, first of all, intend to set out to do them. But at first, they were just very short roundups of what I had seen. And they have gotten far more sophisticated and far more wide-reaching in the last 3 years. And I also said that I would only do them for a few months and then only 100 days into Biden's presidency. And now, you know, who knows? But, you know, I keep saying it's not sustainable, but so far it's been sustainable for more than 3 years.
Well, and you put so much work into it and time. And then, you know, let's be honest, people get really excited for you, I think, mostly when you decide to take a night off and post one of Buddy's beautiful photographs.
Yeah, well, I started doing that actually because of that. We were out hiking in the West, I think in Zion, and I was just exhausted. I mean, I was falling asleep sitting up. And so I had happened to take a really nice picture that day of Zion, and I said, I just can't tonight. You know, this is what I'm doing. You know, please hold on for another day. And people responded so positively. I thought, wait, it's not just me who needs a break. It's everybody else who needs a break. And that's sort of become part of the institution now, Buddy or friends. I mean, lots of people want me to advertise photographers on the site, and I just can't get into that. So it's usually friends who say, here, you want this one? And, you know, sometimes I say yes, and up it goes.
Also, love the podcast that you do with our friend Joanne Freeman, Now and Then. The best part of it is it feels like you're sitting in a room with two incredibly smart, funny friends.
Oh, we have such a good time, you know, and it just, we do it over Zoom so we can actually see each other's faces. And she, you know, she's so understated about so much, and she'll be like, well, you know, when they did this, it was a problem. And I'm like, Joanne, they killed people. It's like more than a problem. And I get this look on my face, and she's like, I believe Heather wants to talk now.
I was just listening to the new one today. So you didn't know who Lizzo was, huh?
I did not. Joanne did. But I knew the origins of rap music. I knew about turntabling. So that's my redemption on that
right,
one. And that one was so much fun to talk about how people make music at whatever it takes to make music. And what I really loved about this episode on how people have made music and then co-opted music and the history of that was the steel drum. I mean, people in Trinidad were told they couldn't use percussion. So first they turned to these drums that they use. So first they turned to bamboo, and then they turned to oil drums. I love that. Like, not in a million years could I be like, oh, look, an oil drum. I know, I can turn that into an instrument. And it just, that was one of my favorite episodes we've ever recorded.
Well, and when you talk about music too, and I've talked about this with students in my history classes before, the whole idea that what we think of as rock and roll essentially was an amalgam of Delta blues that blacks brought with them as they migrated to the north, and southern, largely white country music, and that combination of the two created this new hybrid sound.
Well, it was interesting when we were talking about banjos, because the construction of the banjo from whatever was at hand was very much like what Robert Johnson did when he went down to the crossroads. Of course, there's this great question of what did he do when he disappeared for a little over a year, I think it was, and came back home incredibly talented on the guitar. And there's a wonderful documentary about Robert Johnson called Can't You Hear the Wind Howl, which last I knew was actually on YouTube, I think, or maybe it's somewhere easily accessible. It's a little over an hour. And they actually demonstrate how people in his town used to create essentially a rudimentary guitar through strings hanging on a wall. And that's what made me think of it. It's like, if you could get a musical genius like Robert Johnson and give him a wall, and he creates the instrument that's going to let him become Robert Johnson, right? I think that theme of innovation, but then also the fact that music is so fundamental to humanity, I just find absolutely fascinating and really quite inspirational.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about this a lot here on the show, as we sometimes learn about musicians, depending on where you are in the political spectrum, whether it's us here being horrified that Eric Clapton or Van Morrison is an anti-vaxxer and anti-science, or I'm sure there are plenty of people on the right who get upset that Bruce Springsteen, they just discovered, has a political point of view. Are you able to separate the artist from the music, or in other genres, celebrate actors from what they do in their personal life or things like that?
I have to laugh at that because, of course, Born in the USA, if you actually listen to the lyrics, is, you know, all it is political, right? Mm. And that's always been his thing since, you know, the 1970s, is the decline of the steel towns and what that means both for the people in them and then what it means for the country in general. So whenever anyone's like, oh, he's political, that always sort of amuses me, because one of the great things to teach is Born in the USA. You know, that's a really complicated question, I think, but one of the things that I sort of came at a number of years ago when some actor was doing something completely untoward, is that you have, in a sense, at least I feel like I have, in a sense, with people in different spheres, a contract. Like, my contract with actors is that they do their job, that they entertain me and or teach me something or whatever on the screen. I don't own what they do elsewhere. And I would like to say that's how I feel about these other, about musicians, for example. But I think it does, you know, I used to love Ted Nugent, and I just can't listen to him anymore because I've watched the videos where he's really attacking something I care so deeply about, which is American politics. So I think the principle that you have a contract with somebody and that's their job, they don't have to honor your morality outside of what that contract is a lovely principle. I find it's very hard for me to live with that.
Well, now, of course, we were in uncharted territory there for a few years, but does that principle apply as well to politicians? Because not that many years ago, if you go back even to the Kennedy administration, the press didn't report on a lot of the things that were going on. And if you look at the presidents through history who were unfaithful to spouses, that's going to be a pretty large group of folks there. But we didn't know about that. Does that impact them? And I don't know the answer myself. Can you be a good leader if you do things that are perhaps morally abhorrent?
Well, I think we have to say that yes, you can be, simply because I suspect there's not a single person we can think of in the political realm who hasn't done something that we would find abhorrent at some time in some way. And my big example of that is that, you know, there isn't a lawmaker in our history who hasn't been sexist. I mean, really pretty over the top sexist. And yet, you know, I think Lincoln ended up doing a pretty good job. So I think that personally, I think that one can be a good leader, but I think some of that stuff really matters. So the fact that Richard Nixon put Pat in the hospital and nobody thought it was worth reporting on is a real problem, because we know the link now between domestic abuse and other forms of political violence or political abuse. But the question is, who draws that line? And that's something I think it's really hard to figure. I mean, I'd love to tell you there's a really clear answer, but, you know, what matters? And what matters for the way that somebody leads the country? And I think different people disagree about what that line is. And I don't have a hard and fast one, except that there are certainly things that I think a lawmaker can do that I find makes them, to my mind, unelectable. Other people seem to have different lines.
I wonder, too, if, and I think a lot of this is post-Nixon, we all want a free press. Well, most of us want a free press. But I wonder if we have some good people out there who choose not to run, especially for high-level elective office, because they don't want to open up not only their own life, but the lives of their families to the endless media scrutiny.
Absolutely. And that, I think, is a problem of the media and also, at this point, the right-wing media. I think it's really important to remember that we don't have parallel radicalism in this country. We don't have a both sides problem. It's pretty clear, and I can tell you the history of why this happened, that the Republican Party, the right, has gone very far right. And one of the ways they have done that is by their use of the media. The left has not similarly polarized. They have stayed pretty much the same. If you look at the charts of political scientists and how people vote and what principles they espouse. And one of the things that means is that there's been real asymmetric polarization of the media. So, you know, one of the things that really jumps out to me is right now is the incessant screams on the right about Hunter Biden. Well, Hunter Biden may or may not be a criminal. That's, you know, that's not for me to decide. But he's not in government. At the same time, there is a knee-jerk, you know, you can't go after Trump's children. They were literally in the White House as advisors, and they're in their 40s. They are grown people. And that idea that what matters is the children, unless it's Hunter Biden, and that asymmetric polarization in terms of the media, I think is a real problem, because it leaves you with, what do you do? Do you fight back and say, well, wait a minute, what about this child? Or do you say, you know, there are things that are off limits? And I think what's off limits is people who are not involved in politics.
We're talking with Heather Cox Richardson here on Downtown. We've been here before. We've been divided as a nation. But in the past, and this ties into the discussion of the media, have we had a situation like this where a large percentage of the electorate basically is living in an alternative reality, not accepting the facts that I think the majority accept?
Yes, we have. And actually, it's very sad to me. I was thinking about this. Actually, I told you I was just out kayaking and thinking about this, as one does when one is a historian. And that is in the 1850s in the American South, the elite enslavers. And by that, I mean, they were less than 1% of the American population. So even less than that in they're a very small number of people in the American South. They're not the numbers of enslavers in the South are always a little bit hard to wrap your head around, because most white people lived in proximity to an enslaved person. And I was very careful to say that, because that could mean your dad was the head of the household, but you would live there. But the people who really ran the South were those who enslaved more than 50 people. And they were really an oligarchy, and they were called an oligarchy at the time. And they managed to monopolize the media system in the South, quite literally, by saying you can't deliver this kind of information. If you have, for example, a book called the impending crisis and how to stop it, which was a call to poor whites to say, wait a minute, we got to push back against these guys at the top. If you had that, you were in danger of being lynched or tarred and feathered. You couldn't have Uncle Tom's Cabin. And they made sure that there was not an opportunity for people to listen to, for example, to Abraham Lincoln and to have the media network, that the system that they had, be challenged in any way. And what they ended up with was a population that really believed their lies, but also that, and the reason I was thinking about this is that they sort of thought, I suspect, most of the white men and certainly the women in the South in the 1850s thought, oh, politics, it doesn't interest me. I'm not involved with it. You know, all I know is I want my guys to be in power, without really thinking about that. And when the South Carolina takes the Confederacy out of the Union, and that's an interesting story as well, it's never put to a popular vote. When they take them out of the Union, there's this, oh, rah, rah, I'm going to fight for my people, you know. And then within months, it's very clear that the people who are going to be dying and losing their property are not that very small group of elites. Mm. They're going to be the people on the ground. And part of that is, to me, incredibly sad, because I think you see the same dynamic now. The idea that somehow if you put these radical extremists into office, they're my people. But, you know, I suspect people in Russia would have said the exact same thing, 2 years ago. And now they're literally running for the exits as fast as they can so they don't become cannon fodder. And the other piece of that really jumped out at me while I was thinking about it is, one of the things that I worry a lot about is the real push in MAGA Republicans to force America to default in order to get their way on a lot of things. And again, just like the American South before the Civil War, the American South before the Civil War really was one of the wealthiest, most powerful regions in the world. And in 4 years, they turned it into a backwater from which it really never emerged. And you could argue with me about that after World War II. And I look at that and I think, do you really want to go down a road where we stop being the default currency for the world, where we stop being the debt that is the most valuable in the world? Do you really want to walk away from the table? Because if you think this is going to make us more powerful rather than less, I got a really nice bridge in the Kerch Strait right now that I could sell to you.
I wonder, too, if I were a political strategist, I think I would look at the GOP and say, wow, this is really short-sighted. If you want to maybe win this coming election, okay, but the future of your party isn't great when you embrace not only extreme views, but extremist candidates as well. Is this a similar place to where the Democrats were in the late 1800s?
I think it is, yes. And actually, it's funny you say that because, you know, I'm a historian of the Republican Party, really kind of by accident. I started in this field talking about the Civil War, and you can't do the Civil War without doing the Republicans, and one thing led to another, and I became a historian of the Republican Party. And I love the Republican Party, which will probably surprise a lot of people, but they're my peeps at this point. Like, I know William Pitt Fessenden better than probably anybody else alive. And, you know, I've read everything that John Sherman wrote, and who was William Tecumseh Sherman's brother and a big figure in the economy in the late 19th century. And I know what they thought, and I know how they thought, and I know how that party worked. So I have said for years that the Republican turn toward extremism, which really takes off in the 1990s under Newt Gingrich, is a terrible mistake, because it is not a winning argument in the long term. It's a power argument, but it's a power argument that has, in fact, concentrated wealth really dramatically at the top of the scale. And that when the Republican Party decided to rebuild from the middle, as it did under Teddy Roosevelt, as it did under Eisenhower, it would again become the grand old party. But until then, it was walking off a cliff. And when I wrote in 2014, when I wrote my big history of the Republican Party, people were furious that I said that, because I called it. You could see the pieces moving. And now, of course, we're in a moment when a number of former Republicans over the last, you know, since 2020 have come out against the party and said, we really need to rebuild this from the ground up. And I find that fascinating because, as you say, the Democrats did precisely that in the 1880s after the Confederates took power in 1879 and really tried to force through a program that looked very much like what the Confederacy had tried to do. And they got shellacked politically, nationally, and that's when you get the Democratic turn toward the urban areas and toward the idea of a government that's going to answer workers' needs, which becomes FDR and becomes absolutely unassailable. So I kind of hope we're in this moment, although that being said, you know, the Trumpers really have locked up a lot of the apparatus at the state level that is really undemocratic. And it's not clear to me that even if Americans turn against this party, it's going to be able, we're going to be able to throw them out and rebuild.
And what they're doing doesn't seem to match the changing demographics of the country. But is that in many ways the impetus behind it for some of those MAGA Republicans?
I think that's exactly right. You know, the numbers haven't been there really since about 1986. We start to see voter suppression in 1986. It really takes off in 1994 after the Motor Voter Act of 1993. And, you know, at some point, again, it's not just about the Republican Party, by the way. In any party system, you need to have at least two parties to have a successful democracy. And in any party system, when you stop having to appeal to people who don't like you, you start to become more radical because the only people you care about are those who could primary you from the right. And that is precisely what happened after the 1990s.
We've been at the edge, the precipice of autocracy before. Are we closer than ever right now?
What's different right now, I think, is that we have never been in a position where one of the major parties has embraced anti-democracy, has really rejected democracy. We certainly in the 1890s had a number of leading Americans who no longer believed in democracy. And from that, of course, we got new constitutions in all but one state across the country that restricted voting, not only of African Americans, although that was, of course, the top issue for most of the state constitutions, but also of immigrants and also of poor white men. Women couldn't vote at that point at a national level. So we have had something like this that led to voter suppression, which that's really interesting how that played out. But we have never had a majority of a major political party say, yeah, we're going to toss democracy overboard and we're going to rig our system to make sure that happens. The only other time we had something like that was, of course, with the Civil War.
What percentage of people are we talking about? Because I know when President Biden made his comments, immediately those in the right-wing media rose up and said, well, you just insulted half the country. And I thought, well, no, it's not half the country. But realistically, what percentage of people are in that extreme group?
So it's so interesting you say that, because just by chance, last night I looked up the numbers. We really didn't plan this. I did look up the numbers. And in the middle of September, September 16th, according to Gallup, the number of people who self-identified as Republicans was about 30% of the country. The number that self-identified as Democrats was, I think it was about 27%. I literally don't have these numbers in front of me. But the number who self-identified as independents was 40%.
Wow.
And that I thought was interesting because political scientists will tell you there is no such thing as an independent, that it depends, that they call themselves independents, but there are various psychological reasons that one doesn't want to say, yeah, I'm really a Democrat, or yeah, I'm really a Republican. But it could also be that we are approaching what you just identified, a moment in which we get a major realignment of those independents, which will mean a major realignment of the major political parties.
I also find it ironic, too, that we're seeing this push toward Christian nationalism at a time when the number of people who identify as members of any kind of organized religion are declining nationwide. And I think the highest rate of decrease in those numbers is right here in the state of Maine.
You know, that's a really important observation, and it's true, because one of the things that any political observer will tell you is that if, for example, a group feels like they're in power, they don't feel the need to squish everybody else because, you know, they're going to win. They don't have to try and undercut their opponents. It's when they feel threatened that they feel the need to rig the system, if you will. And you know, one of the things I always think about when I think about that is Vladimir Putin's reaction to Alexei Navalny. Now, if he really felt, that is, Putin really felt that he were in charge of Russia, he would not need to be persecuting Alexei Navalny, because you can sort of pat the little people on the head and say, yes, yes, dear, go ahead and oppose me, because I know I'm going to win in a landslide. I can afford to humor you because I know I'm in power. It's really when people feel like they're on the ropes that they begin to put in place the kinds of repressive legislation that we're seeing now.
We talk a lot about it here on the show, but the push in recent years has been to get not those national offices. Sure, the Republicans want to control the House and the Senate, but really they put additional focus into not only elected jobs, but some of those volunteer jobs on voter registration boards, being election observers, local school boards and things of that sort. Is that part of an organized strategy to really begin to impact policy from the ground up rather than from the top down?
Yes, it is. It's a policy that has really taken off since the Trump administration and during the Trump administration, because Steve Bannon was very aware of how important that was. Steve Bannon being a former leader of Breitbart and now has I guess I shouldn't do his advertising for him, but he is an ally, I wouldn't say a friend, but an ally of former President Trump. But it's not a new strategy. This is actually one of the interesting things that came out of the Goldwater candidacy in 1964, because Goldwater recognized when the leaders of both parties, really, but certainly the Republican Party, turned against him and began to support his opponents, that he was best served by trying to whip up people at the ground level. Because the reality is, most people do not pay attention to their local races. They do not pay attention to their states. They don't call their state reps. They don't complain. And that if you could get people, for example, to sit on the Texas school board, you could have a dramatic impact on textbooks, for example. That's where that whole movement came from. So the right, again, has been very good about that in a way that white Democrats have not been. Black Democrats actually have had a history of recognizing just how important things were at the local level. So the right certainly has tried to put a lot of effort into the school boards, the local school boards, and local town offices, for example. But that is almost never homegrown. That is part of a larger strategy. It is more homegrown, or has been more homegrown until recently, among the Democrats. That being said, there are now a number of Democratic organizations that are trying to get people to turn out and show up, for example, for their state offices or their local offices.
And of course, Republicans clearly understood better than Democrats the power and the import of getting people appointed to federal judgeships.
Federal judgeships, which has been afoot since Ed Meese, since Reagan's Attorney General Ed Meese started that in the 1980s, very deliberately. He said he was doing it. So doing that, but also at the state level, one of the important things about things that are happening at the state level is that first of all, it's cheap to buy a state office. And I don't mean to bribe state legislators. That people think that when you talk about corruption, somebody's pocketing cash, and maybe a few are. But what I really mean is that it's much cheaper to elect somebody to a state representative seat than it is to elect somebody to a national level. It's just much cheaper. The flyers are cheaper. You have to have much less airtime. You know, it's just a much cheaper proposition. So beginning in 2010, the Republicans launched a project called Operation Red Map, called Republican Redistricting Majority Project, which was designed to take over the state houses so they could then take over redistricting. So then, even if they lost the popular vote at the state level, they would still control a majority of the seats in the state houses and also then in the House of Representatives. And it's really pretty dramatic. In 2012 in Pennsylvania, the Democrats for state offices won, I believe it was 51.5% of the vote. This is off the top of my head. I don't have it in front of me. But they got something like 38% of the seats in that state house. And so one of the things that has put us in the position we're in now is the undemocratic nature of state houses at this point. And it was very easy to do. Now, there's no reason, it seems to me, that you couldn't do the opposite, that the Democrats couldn't organize at that level and do the opposite. But that's where we are right now and how we got there.
We're talking with Heather Cox Richardson here on Downtown. All right, kind of a personal question here as you get going each evening to start working on the letters. Is there one aspect of the American story right now that tires you out, that makes you say, oh, I have to write about this again? It's exhausting.
It's not so much that, because I find the whole tapestry fascinating. It is more that I the thing that is hard for people like me is watching the ball roll and pick up steam and have so many people still not see it. Because literally people who study politics have seen this moment coming and have been screaming about it now for decades. So, for example, I wrote a column last night about some of the extremist rhetoric coming out of the current crop of MAGA Republicans. And I didn't even put all that much stuff in it because, to be honest, I was trying to do something else at the same time. And people seemed horrified by that. And, oh, my God, this is the worst thing I've ever read. And part of me is like, at this point, how can you not see it? Because I tend to be Pollyannish, and even, I mean, even I've been able to see it for a long time. So I think that's what tires me out. It's like, yeah, they said something else that was completely over the top again. And I hate having to pay attention to that day after day after day, but it's important to.
What do you do to get away from it all, to unwind? Do you read a book? Do you listen to music? Obviously, you go kayaking. What are the ways you escape all of this?
Music is always on. So that's there. You know, honestly, I've been going way too hard for 3 years now. So in the past, I would have knit. I don't know what the past tense of knit is. I knit. I cook. I'm a big baker. And so I would procrastinate bake, as they say. Lots of outside time. But most of the time these days, I'm tied to a machine just because it's hard to watch the news. You have to watch the news all day to see what's happening.
Do you have
if you start writing early, you got to pray nothing else happens after you've already written.
Right. Do you have a potential release date for the new book?
Yeah, it'll be out in a year.
Excellent.
Then I'll tell you more about it when we get closer.
That sounds great. And I have to ask you too, what's a good main getaway? Is there a place that you, when you have the time, when you're not tied to that computer, a place in the state where you can just get away, absorb nature, get some peace?
Well, of course, I live in paradise. So my happy place is staying home. It's my lobster fisherman partner who's like, let's hit the road. Let's go somewhere. I absolutely love Tumbledown Mountain. It's my favorite mountain in the state, although I should not say I have a favorite because that'll upset people from other places. I love the Rockland Breakwater. That's huge for me. Morse's Mountain. Is the walk down Morse's Mountain is one of my absolute favorites as well. And then there's our art museums and our historical collections, which are really fabulous. And I don't just mean the biggies that people know about, Maine Historical, for example. I mean the town historical associations are, you know, I try and work every year at the Yarmouth Library and go over to the Yarmouth Historical Society. And anytime I'm in a town, I try and hit their historical societies.
Well, Heather, it's wonderful to catch up with you. We appreciate it so much. I want to mention, of course, that you'll be at the University of Maine on Friday, 3:00 at the Collins Center with Brian Naylor, discussing the future of the humanities, a celebration of a decade of the McGillicuddy Humanities Center. So check that out. And of course, subscribe to the newsletter, follow Heather on Twitter, and be looking for that book down the road in a year. Good to talk with you again. Good to see you face to face.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here. Sorry it took us so long to make this work, but we'll do it again soon.